Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, September 1st, 2021. The first day of September is also the 244th day of the year. And as always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're live or in the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my 47 years of doing therapy. And these tools are quite gratefully available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that webpage, click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect in my life over the past 17-plus years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to help me turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Download it, print it off, use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and thereby get access to a completely free and private app. Before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. And when you tap on that, you'll download an app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows like this one, where people have been stepped through the use of the worksheet process or given powerful testimonials about the positive effects of using that tool in their lives. And there's a whole host of those shows that have been curated out of the more than 10 years of archives of this show. So they've been singled out as being highlight shows. And if you listen to those repeatedly, they will serve as a tutorial for you to help you learn to improve your skills in the use of this tool and eventually master it. We help people do that soon and often, and then when you do, it raises questions, hopefully, comments, testimonials. So then give us a call at 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. We're also in the middle of a year where we've made the commitment to work through the Course in Miracles workbook lessons, and today is the 244th day of the year, and today's lesson reads, I am in danger nowhere in the world. Regulatory speech would have me say, I am perfectly safe everywhere I am. The commentary here reads, your son is safe wherever he may be, for you are there with him. He needs but call upon your name, and he will remember his safety and your love, for they are one. How can fear or doubt fail to know that he cannot suffer, be endangered, or experience unhappiness when he belongs to you, the Creator, the beloved and loving, in the safety of your creative embrace. And there we are in truth. No storms can come into the hallowed haven of our home. In the Creator we are secure. For what can come to threaten creation itself or make afraid what will forever be a part of creation? And the Pam Grout's Course in Miracle Experiment book, Lesson 244, is titled Claiming Joy and Ease. She quotes Alexander Marchand as saying, as characters in the universe game, we are no more simply our bodies than we are red and black checkers on a game board. Bodies are merely a means of interacting with the probability database called the quantum field. Pam writes, for 3 decades, I have enjoyed a pretty sweet gig as a travel writer. I get paid to jet off to really cool places to do things I would probably never do on my own. In Lesson 224, I am in danger nowhere in the world. This lesson often comes in handy for me. 2 days before I was scheduled to leave for an assignment in Turkey, the State Department issued a travel advisory. Pam writes, I pay no attention to such things, but several worried friends emailed me the alert. One of the other journalists backed out. So I had a choice. I could believe the ego's messaging, danger ahead, or I could focus on today's lesson. I am forever grateful that I chose to claim safety and ease. Not only did I visit ancient archaeological sites, tea plantations, and remote mountain villages, but I stayed in the same Sultan's palace where Madonna and her 25-year-old boy toy stayed during her infamous Flash the Crowd concert. Turkey also displayed another potent metaphysical truth, quote, to give and receive are one in truth, close quotes. Everywhere we went, Turkish families invited us into their homes, fed us the most stupendous meals, and let me tell you, Turkish cuisine is beyond spectacular, and honored us as treasured guests. I have never felt more loved, more secure, or more sure that people everywhere are infinitely beautiful, kind, and filled with love. There is no better way to learn about abundance than to give it away. So that's our Course in Miracles commentary and the Course in Miracles lesson today from the workbook, lesson number 244. And we have about 50 minutes left to hold a conversation, discuss a topic, receive a testimonial, help somebody frame out a worksheet, work through a worksheet. I have a list of things to talk about if no one raises a hand, but we're always willing to have somebody raise a hand and help us by selecting the topic or asking specifically a question about one of the tools that are available at whyagain.org. Last night was Tuesday, so we had a support group. We had 4 people plus me, and we had a Guy Finley talk from 2016 that one of our members wanted to suggest or request, and so we listened to that. And it was interesting that it stirred up so much for people that even though someone had requested time to do a worksheet, the commentary, the reaction, the processing that happened after that Guy Finley talk took up almost all of the rest of our time. So, our call-in number is 563 888-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. I believe I reported yesterday that Dr. Richard Moss has agreed to an interview. After much back and forth, I finally booked an interview with Dr. Bradley Nelson, who wrote the Emotion Code book, which is such a powerful tool. It's very similar to the neuroemotional technique, which is one of the most powerful tools I've ever encountered for use in individual sessions with people, and have it done on me on a regular basis. And I've had a series of sessions with people that have potentially useful topics to discuss, and we have time for you to suggest something. We've got 47 minutes left, and the call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1, and we can have a conversation. I had somebody was asking about how do you sort out the conflict, the emotions, the dynamic in a situation where you do something because you feel someone is forcing you to do it, and then you have resentment because you did it. And from our culture, from our languaging and from our conditioning, it's very difficult to sort that out because we are taught to think in terms of, you made me do this. You are making me angry. You made me make this extra stop that's going to make us late, and I'm the one driving the car. You made me have an accident because you started yelling and screaming while I was backing up, and that caused me to not be able to concentrate, and that's why I had an accident. You know, one of the situations that happened, I worked with a family where there was a teen driver with a permit, and his parent was in the car, and they were backing down a long, dark driveway, and he was driving, the teen was driving, and the parent thought the teen was going too fast and started telling him, slow down, stop, you're going to hurt, and just got agitated in a loud voice, and predictably, the teen overreacted in the wrong way, and the rear quarter panel of the car had a very abrupt interaction with a telephone pole and resulted in hundreds and hundreds of dollars of damage to the car. It didn't ruin the car, but there was a quarter panel that was all scraped up and needed to be replaced. And the parent was furious with the teenager, and the teenager was furious with the parent, and it went back and forth. And the parents kept presenting to the teenager, look, you're driving, you're responsible for what happens in the car, what happens with the car, where it goes, if it hits something, you're responsible. You're the one driving, you're responsible. Was it a good thing for the other parent to, you know, get excited and yell? No, it wasn't the best thing to do, but that's not what caused you to react the way you did. And so you just, this is a learning lesson. But you have to take responsibility. You have to own the mistake in order to get the benefits of the lesson. Well, about, you know, a month or two later, the same parent that was so agitated in the car backs the car out of the garage and hit some objects that belonged to the teenagers. And that parent got out of the car and started yelling about how the kids were responsible for not putting the stuff away, and that's why the things got hit. And the teenagers, pretty bright, had been through this a couple months before, said, hey, the lesson we got from you adults is whoever's driving the car is responsible. And, of course, the parent didn't want to hear that and got all kinds of upset and agitated. And how do you sort it out? who's responsible, who's causing the emotion. You know, this happens all the time. I had a couple in not long ago, and they were talking about how she made him do this or that. And he was the one who got up on the roof to do the thing. Well, she didn't make him get up there. She had her thoughts. She had her strong emotions. She has her history of raging and, you know, name-calling or swearing or whatever. But name-calling and swearing has never made anybody do a behavior. If somebody is trying to control the person who's name-calling or swearing or take responsibility for their or avoid having that other person name-call or swear or get agitated, they can choose to do actions. In this work, we understand it is quite misguided because nothing I do causes or controls the emotional response of another person. But, of course, predictably, when this person got up on the ladder, on the roof to do this thing, it didn't go so well. And he almost fell all the way off the roof, and he was furious at her because, quote, she made him get up on the ladder. And this almost resulted in his serious injury or death. And they were going back and forth, and they were asking me, how do you sort this out? I mean, like, you know, she would have raged if I hadn't gone up there. And then I went up there, and I almost died. So she made me go up there, and she made me almost kill myself. Well, the bottom line is, in the bottom line observation number three is, I can't make anybody do anything they don't want to do. Now, in the full lecture that I give on that particular topic, the rest of the statement is, everybody does what they choose to do based on what they have control over and what they want to gain and what they want to avoid. So I might have control over some factors that my employees want the benefits of, like paid time off or a raise or their paycheck at the end of the month or, you know, an extended lunch hour or the ability to play their boombox, you know, on site at the job, whatever. I might have control over those factors or rules or regulations. But I don't have control over their behavior. I might have control over putting a write-up in their employee file or docking them some pay or firing them, but I don't have control over how they behave when they are on the job site. They either decide they want to earn the bonus or the regular pay or my approval or extra time off or overtime, and they might choose to follow the rules or stay late and work harder, or they might choose to constantly complain and go home early and not really put their heart into things. And they might blame it on my rules or on my, you know, being angry or whatever. But what I do doesn't cause their behavior. They choose to do what they choose to do. In trying to gain something they want to gain or avoid something they don't want to have happen to them. And that's, I would offer for your observation, that that's what drives everybody doing everything. Michael Rice would say the only reason anybody does anything is because they've got a reality in their mind telling them to do it. And if the reality in my mind says the best way for me to get the bonus I want is to follow all the boss's rules and show up when she says to show up and, you know, treat her nicely when she has an anger outburst, and if that's what my mind tells me to do and that's what I want to achieve, that's what I'll do. And the fact of it is, she doesn't make me do anything. My boss doesn't make me do anything. You know, there are all kinds of people these days. I just heard about several people yesterday who showed up at a business, various businesses, it wasn't just one business, and they refused to wear a mask. But the business had the policy that everybody there would wear a mask. Well, nobody made those people wear a mask. The business had the liberty to go ahead and call the police when the people got loud and negative. But calling the police still doesn't make somebody wear a mask. The person still has to make the choice. Do I wear the mask, or do I risk going to jail, or do I not get to partake in the benefits of this business? So in this example of the husband who ends up getting up on the roof because, quote, his wife made him and he's almost seriously injured or killed, he wants me to join him in talking about how it's all her fault. And, of course, I couldn't do that because my observations about what people do and when they do it and how they do it lead me to understand observation number 3, I can't make anybody do anything they don't want to do. And this person kept coming on and on about, well, but if I hadn't gotten up on the roof, it would have been a miserable week or month. I mean, and if I had hired somebody else to do it, I never would have heard the end of it. We don't have the money for that, and you're frivolous with our money. And so that's, he kept trying to get me to understand how she had made him get up on the roof. And I kept trying to help him understand that as a, you know, 64-year-old individual who has various issues of coordination and, you know, he's had injuries and knee problems and things like that, it's his job to know what his body can safely do or not do, and it's his job to make decisions about whether or not to get up on ladders or climb on roofs. It's not anybody else's responsibility to do that. He didn't like that. But then when we started talking about it from a different perspective, we put another situation on the table. What if your wife had told you, I'm going to scream at you for a month unless you go get that gun that's, you know, in the gun safe and go over and shoot our neighbor's house to warn them about playing their music too loud? And he started to chuckle, and he said, I would never do that. We don't even have a gun safe. And I said, all right, well, let's pretend you have a gun safe in your house, and there's a gun in there, and your wife gets angry because the neighbor plays music too loud, and she wants you to go do that. I would never do that, he says. And I said, well, but according to the way you're reporting this story, she could make you do that by simply threatening to make your life miserable for a month. And he pushed back, and he said, no, she could never make me do that. And I said, okay, Your Honor, I rest my case. He said, what do you mean? Just like she could never make you pull a gun out of your gun safe and shoot your neighbor's house to try and intimidate them, she did not make you get up on the roof. You chose to get up on the roof because you were weighing the benefits of trying to risk your physical safety to try and control her emotions versus not doing what she wanted and your imagined future of her rage and how uncomfortable your life would be. So you made a decision or a choice, and that's all there is to that. Now, if you have resentment immediately after you do that or when it goes badly, that's your work to do, to dismantle your resentment, because when anybody chooses an action, it's going to have consequences. This is physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. This is, you know, the karma laws. This is whatever. Everybody understands in one way or another that my actions have consequences. Some are consequences that I really enjoy. Some are consequences that I call rewards. Some are consequences that I don't enjoy, and I call them punishments. But every time I make a choice, it has a ripple effect in my life. This person chose to do what his wife was, quote, requiring him to do or telling him to do, even though it was against his better judgment and it involved things that, because of his physical limitations, were unsafe. And after he did that, then he wanted me to join him in being angry at his wife for, quote, making him do that. And it's just not a good system. It just doesn't. The way we observe people on the planet and the way thoughts lead to emotions and how goals are involved, the way we understand the way the system works, that is not a useful thing. To pretend that somebody else has made me do something and somebody else is responsible for my behaviors and the consequent emotional responses. So what I try to do whenever people are willing to do that is help them do the worksheets, the reality management worksheets, to dismantle the negative emotional state that they are generating by the thoughts they're pouring their mind energy into and by the goals that they're focused on over which they have no control. Now, if you have control over a goal and you can make sure it gets accomplished and you think it's going to be in your best interest, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, by all means, set that goal and go accomplish it. However, when you think you have control over a goal and you set it and you think it's going to be good for you physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and it doesn't get accomplished, you will probably feel a negative emotional state, a tension, a resistance, a fear, an anger, a sadness, a hurt, a guilt, a shame, a resentment. When that happens, the most useful thing I can offer is to call a timeout. Take a nice deep breath where you hold it at the top of the inhale. Slow the exhale down so it's 10 seconds or longer in the exhale. Turn the focus inside yourself and figure out, what is it that I have all of my energy focused on here that I have no control over? What is the thought I'm using to generate this emotion? How am I creating this emotion? Alternatively, what am I making this situation mean? And eventually, what's the goal that I'm focused on that I have no control over accomplishing that is right now blocking my ability to see the depth of my consciousness that holds the negative emotion that I'm experiencing? Yes. If I'm married to somebody or if I'm in a business relationship with somebody who has a tendency to get angry and they tell me to do something that I don't think is safe or right or I'm not willing to do and I refuse to do it, they are quite likely going to get angry. That's what they're going to do. That's their choice. That's their decision. As Michael Rice would say, I don't have any control over that. I do, however, when I choose to exercise it, have control over what I say and do. And when I wake up and realize that I can't control anybody else's emotions and they're not controlling mine and I can't make anybody do anything they don't want to do, I can take that breath, get myself centered, shift the focus inside myself and accurately assess, based on everything that's going on around me, what are the things I actually have control over, and what are the things I don't have control over? My experience has been, and I believe you'll find this to be the same for yourself, that when you do that, and you've been upset, and that's what prompted you to initiate that process, you will find that most, if not all, of your energy is focused on things you have almost absolutely no control over. And the only way out of that system is to selectively pick the focus of your attention away from things you cannot control and shift it over to the things you can, implement a plan of action based on things you can actually control, and then take an action on that plan. this system will go far better if you have tools like the reality management worksheet or the targeted journaling that Michael calls the mind shifter tool, and you use that to dismantle the mechanisms in you that are generating the negative emotions before you do the analysis of what you have control over and formulating a plan. Because when the negative emotions are active, they distort your perception. They distort my perception. They distort perception. And oh, the tangled web we weave when first we practice to perceive, especially when there is emotion up in our field, because the emotion distorts the perception. And perception is our best guess. It's our sometimes very shaky copy of actuality. And this is why so many conflicts, this is why all of the conflicts happen. People have their truth. This has been a theme in the support group over the past few weeks. We've had people who've wanted to talk about and set goals of and do worksheets about the truth. And they're angry because people won't see the truth. And I've made the suggestion several times in the past few weeks that the person working on that worksheet can benefit tremendously, can open up all kinds of potential and possibility if he or she will simply, instead of saying, I'm upset because this person won't see the truth, if they will just write, I'm generating this upset because this person won't see the truth as I see it. Just that much to acknowledge that I'm the one that's creating what I see. I'm the one that my perception is creating the pictures that my mind shows me. And in the core of this work, we understand that whenever my mind is showing me pictures and the resultant energy in my field is a negative emotional state, I could wake up and realize that the picture my mind is showing me is not the full picture. It's not accurate. It's not actuality through a clear filter, through the RACMA filter, to see life as it actually is. It's the perceptual guess, my best guess. It's the picture my mind showing me when the distortions are in place, the negative emotions of hostility and fear and or any of their stepchildren. And I am not seeing my own life and the people around me clearly whenever there's a negative emotion active in my field. So when somebody gets upset and they think they're upset because another person made them do something, or their perceptions are off. They're trying to live their life according to the rules or the beliefs or the prescriptions of the culture, and that is just a recipe for more war, more conflict, more divorce, more rage, more hurt. But when people begin to take a step back and learn to live in the question, learn to live by observation rather than belief, when people are willing to actively work to dismantle the conditioned process in their own mind, the belief about this or that, infinite possibilities open up when I begin to question. And fortunately, with this work, I can go many steps beyond that very quickly by simply applying the tool to dismantle the roots of the negative emotion that are within me and therefore under my control, and open a world of possibility, a world of options I hadn't seen even moments before. And from that new range of possibilities, I'm almost always going to get better results. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. When's the last time you generated anger and your mind was telling you you're angry because somebody made you do something you didn't want to do? When's the last time you did something that you didn't want to do in truth because you were trying to control, avoid, or promote a certain reaction, emotional reaction from another person or a series of people. What we know in this work is that all of that is in error. When I do something, Michael Rice likes to use the word propitiation. And the definition for propitiation he uses is the little poem that says, "'Tis the highest treason to do the right thing for the wrong reason." Well, it might be the right thing to do for you to get on the roof and try and fix what's wrong. But if you're only doing it because you're trying to avoid your partner's anger, that's the wrong reason. And no matter what else goes on, you've also created another mess of a dynamic in the relationship between you and your partner. How so? Because you're acting in a way that's trying to control his or her emotions. And you don't have any actual control over his or her emotions. You are not powerful enough to make them angry or make them sad or make them hurt or make them feel guilty. You do not have the power to ruin someone else's self-esteem. I know this is a touchy topic for people. But the fact of the matter is my emotions are not created by the people and things outside of me. There is a dynamic that's observable, and I can have, you know, four or five people, even in the same family, who witness a raging alcoholic mother or father, and some of those people come away quite traumatized in a way that affects their ability to live their life productively or have a healthy, loving relationship or have their own children. And other members of that family reach very different levels of proficiency and accomplishment in relationships and business. So it isn't just the abusive interaction. It's the abusive interaction mixing with the interpretations of the individuals that are witnessing it and the choice of the focus of the energy and how I'm going to cope with if I'm exposed to somebody who's abusive, angry, drunken, etc. And when I interact with somebody who's abusive or angry or drunken, they do not cause my anxiety or fear. The emotions that I generate in order to try and cope with it or deal with it as best I can are the anxiety or the fear or the resentment or the hurt. And they are those responses that my system chooses based on, you know, the best I have to offer in the moment or the best I know how to do. And when I'm a 2-year-old or a 5-year-old, I've got one set of resources and options. And when I'm a 62-year-old or 65-year-old, hopefully I've got a whole different set of resources and options. But if I'm a 65-year-old and my traumatized 7-year-old gets activated in me and I'm not conscious and I haven't practiced the awareness that I'm the one that creates my emotions, I will quite likely have my 65-year-old self get hijacked by my 7-year-old traumatized emotion and mindset. And I will end up acting as a 65-year-old exactly as I did when I was a traumatized 7-year-old. And there's a wonderful tool on the reality management on the whyagain.org website, whyagain.org. It's called the 3 Early Memories of Conflict. And that's a tool that can help me, with repeated use, go back and uncover what were those traumas? What were those false beliefs? What were those trauma energies that I downloaded when I was quite a bit younger than I am today that continually get activated and hijack my behavior when I face a conflict or confrontational situation as an adult? Highly recommend that worksheet for multiple applications, just like I highly recommend the reality management worksheet for multiple applications. And some people in the support group yesterday were saying, yeah, but won't I ever be over this? Can't I ever be done with this? Am I always going to have to be X, Y, and Z? And I don't really know the answer to that. I do know that I don't expect to be done, perhaps, in this lifetime. One of my favorite perspectives on that said, well, listen, if you are an infinite piece of the consciousness, if you are part of an infinite expanding creation, and if your consciousness is part of the one mind, which is an infinite intelligence, how could you ever expect to be done learning about yourself? So that's one perspective I take. And, you know, there are times when I don't like the work I have to do. I would rather have it be easier. And that's, you know, if I'm referring to my mental, emotional, spiritual work, whatever you want to call it. But when I stop and think about it, in truth, that's true for every aspect of my life. Right? I didn't really like how much work it took to get my doctorate. I didn't like how much work it took to get out of high school. I didn't really like how much work it took to start my own private practice and to, you know, struggle for years not knowing how I was going to pay the bills and feed the kids. I didn't like any of that. So whether it's my spiritual, mental, or emotional work, or my, you know, business practice, financial work, I don't think it's ever going to be done. Just like I don't think I'm going to reach the point one day where I'm never going to have to eat again, or I'm never going to have to bathe again, or I'm never going to have to get the car filled with gas again. So when I find myself wishing that I didn't have to do my work, I realize that's a wounded part of me. That's a younger part of me with unrealistic expectations. And it's okay for me to be gentle with that part of me. It's okay for me to acknowledge, yes, that part is probably tired and feeling overwhelmed and maybe feeling hopeless that it's ever going to, you know, finish, reach the goal, be good enough, etc. And I can be gentle with myself as I comfort that part of me that has those thoughts and emotions. And yet, I don't really think I'm going to find this magic tool that lets me be done with my rage or my spiritual work, etc. I am not in the position where I want to get rid of my anger. I'm in the position at this stage of my development and study of these things that I realize that my anger is a really useful tool. It's a warning device. It's part of what wakes me up to the fact that I'm off the mark. And I'm not trying to get rid of my anger. I'm trying to use it appropriately. You know, the analogy that I used, and it came out in one of the teacher trainings at Heartland one time, was the best use of my emotions is as an alarm to wake me up to the fact that there is a problem. And the real, one of the big, big difficulties with our culture is our culture has trained us to believe that when we have an emotion that's a negative emotion within us, that means that's an alarm trying to tell us that someone or something outside of us is wrong or has a problem. And what came to me to talk about at Heartland in that teacher training was, okay, but how many people have a smoke alarm in their house? Everybody raises their hand. So how many of you, if that alarm goes off at 2:30 or 3 in the morning and wakes you from a sound sleep, would think about picking up the phone, calling 911, and sending the fire department to a house 3 blocks down and on the other side of the street? Well, everybody laughs. Of course, no one would do that. Why? Aren't you considerate about your neighbors? What if they have a fire down there? Why would you think there's a fire down there? Well, because the alarm went off. And the audience says, yeah, but the alarm went off in your house. That means that's where the problem is. And I say, okay, that's my point exactly. If I use my negative emotions as an alarm to wake me up that there's a problem, it's a problem where I'm feeling the emotion. It's in me. The problem is not in the person, place, or situation outside of me. It never has been. It never can be. This is why people, the great spiritual teachers for thousands of years, have talked about peace is not about living in a completely calm world. Peace is about being able to be calm in the middle of the chaos around you. So if I can wake up to the fact that my negative emotional states are trying to alert me, they are my alarm system. I wouldn't want to get rid of my emotional states, my negative emotional states, any more than I'd want to rip the alarm system out of my house. The alarm system went off. It alerted me that there was a fire. I called the fire department. They came. They put the fire out, and I say, good, I'm done with that. On your way out, guys, why don't you rip all the wires out of the alarm system? I don't need that anymore. Well, that's ridiculous. I wouldn't do that. Well, my ability to get triggered, my negative emotional states are as valuable to me as an alarm system in a house or a warehouse or a high rise. The issue is the proper use of those energies and the proper integration of the information that comes from those energies with the use of tools like the ones at whyagain.org have enabled me to spend the tiniest fraction of my life experiencing the negative emotions today compared to what it was 25, 30 years ago. Just like when the alarm goes off in the building, call the fire department, and we know they're coming and the building's empty, we don't leave the alarm running. We turn the alarm off because it's an annoying noise. So once I identify that, you know, the anger has arisen within me, I don't need to let it keep raging. I don't need to try and use it as a tool. Right? And my anger is never going to put out the fire of my anger. Some people say it's good to get your anger out. You know, that's kind of antiquated thinking. There have been lots of research that demonstrates if you get into expressing your anger and letting yourself rage and punching pillows and spewing everything you don't like at your partner, it just feeds your rage. Right? That in the analogy of the alarm, I've got this blaring siren that's going off, and it's telling me that there's a fire or, you know, a problem with the water system. Well, if I think that the alarm is going to be the solution to the problem, like I think my rage is going to help me deal with this bad situation, then I just keep raging at the situation. That's as crazy as taking the alarm off the wall and holding the blaring sound over to the flames, expecting the sound from the alarm to put out the fire. It's not going to put out the fire. Acting from my anger isn't going to solve any problems in my life. It's going to compound them. The anger is the alarm to tell me what I've been doing with my thought processes is in error. That the anger is the alarm to alert me that I've been misapplying my mental and emotional energy. And the misapplication of my mind energy is the cause of the vast majority of my pain and all of my suffering. So, 563-999-3581. We have 10 minutes left. What are your thoughts? What are your comments? What's a question? What's an answer? What's a suggested topic or an author that you'd like us to explore? 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1. We can have a conversation or we can discuss a topic of your choosing. Or we can entertain your suggestions about who else we should be interviewing for Mindshifters Radio, or that makes me think of on Monday I did a replay of an interview I did with Robert Whitaker, who's an author and a journalist, an investigative journalist who's written a couple books on mental health in America. And after I had that, I had a conversation with someone who said, you know what? What you're talking about right now, Dr. Tim, that should be on another internet show. And what that topic was the idea of a common sense way to talk about depression. And depression is just a word, right? In a very real sense, there's no such thing as depression. And yet, people have, you know, an experience that similar to a lot of other people where they feel low energy or they've got negative thoughts that influence their mood and can be so intense that they have difficulty functioning, etc. And yet the fact of the matter is no one's ever going to take a blood test and analyze the results and say, oh, this person's got depression. Like they might, you know, take a blood test and say, oh, this person has this parasite. Or, oh, this person has German measles. Well, there is no such thing as that for any of these mental emotional labels that they call diagnoses. So depression is just like that. It's a word that's intended to be a shorthand way of talking about a collection of symptoms or patterns of experience or behavior or mood. And what I talk about it with people is I say, look, when most people talk about depression, they talk about this image in their head of somebody who's feeling sad, down in the dumps, blue, depressed, helpless, hopeless, suicidal. Maybe they're laying in their bed with the covers pulled over their head and the shades drawn, or they're sitting in the back of some psychiatric unit of a hospital, drugged heavily so they don't, you know, try and hurt themselves. And people, you know, most of the time people these days get that image in their head and they say, well, you know, that's not me. I'm functioning. I'm going to school, going to work, taking care of the kids, or doing all four things. And so instantly they rule out the possibility that they might have a difficulty that has anything to do with this word that represents these symptoms of depression. And when I talk to people about that, I say, you know, the sadness that's in that first deep description is just one of five aspects or ingredients that I talk to people about with depression. So sadness is the first. The next one is anger. The next one is obsession. The next one is anxiety. And the last one is this combination of factors, a decrease in my productive energy level in combination with a sense of feeling overwhelmed. And the issue is that any one of those things in small doses is normal. It's normal. We're just talking about the negative emotional states as being normal and being a useful tool to alert me of the processing of my mind being on target or off target. However, I talk to people about with each of these how people who've been working in the field know for years that anger is very closely related to depression. Some people have this hypothesis that anger is depression turned, or depression is anger turned inward. You know, I'm angry at my boss, but I can't afford to lose my job. If I speak up at her, she's going to fire me. So I keep turning it inside, and eventually, I'm so worn out by turning that anger toward myself that I get depressed. This is a hypothesis, but some people, you know, have put that forward. And we see irritable, angry people rage for years and then slowly lose the energy for it and then slide into depression. So that we see that pattern. So we know that there's this thing that happens where people are highly irritable. They have increased irritability and decreased frustration tolerance. And you can have a situation where somebody is so angry that the ice cubes won't come out of the ice tray the right way that they want to rip the freezer door off. But 10 minutes later, that very same person can be the most action-oriented, level-headed person at the scene of an accident. And the accident might be on their front lawn where it's caused damage to their house and their landscaping, but they are not raging at the person. They're action-oriented and level-headed. So it's a very weird thing that some people can handle the big things when they're depressed, but they can't handle the little irritations. The next thing is obsession. And I talk to people about how obsession means thinking the same thought or group of thoughts over and over and over again, despite the fact that there's a part of my brain that knows, well, Tim, this is silly. There's nothing you can do about that. Just move on. At its best, that's irritating and distracting. At its worst, it can actually be a debilitating condition where I just can't get things done because I'm so bogged down in the negative thoughts and obsessions. And clearly, that classic kind of depression we talked about would be nothing if it weren't for thinking the same negative and helpless and hopeless thoughts over and over and over again. So clearly, there's an obsessive component to most people's depression. The next aspect or ingredient I talk to people about is anxiety. What's that? It's a restless, uncomfortable energy that makes me feel like I want to go someplace else or do something else, but I've got no idea where I want to go or what I want to do. And it might have me pacing and wringing my hands in the doctor's office and talking about how I can't manage the kids and the finances and my relationship and the marriage and the house and the job stresses. And the doctor calms me down and says, "That's relax. You know, I know what's going on here." And she says, "Here." And she writes out a prescription for a tranquilizer and gives it to me. Now, for some people who get that, it's a solution. It calms the agitation. They can look around their life. They can see the things that are out of whack. They can change them, and it gets better. But when the pattern of what's going on is this bigger constellation of problems that is going on in the life, in the sense of purpose, in the way the brain is functioning, in the diet and exercise, in the sense of community or love, and when these things are all out of whack, you give somebody like that a tranquilizer, and they go from pacing and wringing their hands, talking about all the job and the finances and the relationship. Next thing you know, they're sitting there calmly, but their affect hasn't lifted, and they're going, "Oh, my God, my job, my wife's relationship, my finances, these kids are driving me crazy." So it doesn't do anything to resolve the underlying dynamic. And the last aspect or ingredient is that combination of a decrease in energy in combination with a sense of feeling overwhelmed. Well, the point of the matter is most people are not stuck in their bed with the covers pulled over their head or in the back ward of a psychiatric unit. Most people who struggle with or suffer from depression are living. They're getting things done. They have a job. They've got a house. They've got kids. They're going to school, whatever. But they're just barely getting done what they need to get done each day. And at the end of the day, they're burned out. And they kill time until it's time for bed, doing things they don't really need to do and things that aren't really nourishing or nurturing. And so it's the combination of one or more of those five factors to a point where it's making your life uncomfortable that leads me to tell people you should go get help, because there are solutions to this thing they're calling depression, but it's just a word. But when you look at it in terms of a pattern of skills for life functioning and level of functioning, and you do an assessment and say, "You know what? I'm not really functioning optimally. There's probably a better way for me to function," then I encourage people to go get help. So that's our show for today. We've got another hour coming up with Michael and Jeannie. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And if you want a summary of that common sense way to talk about depression within the next day or two, that will be on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website under the educational materials page. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tan. I appreciate that. Very good.
Have a great show.
Thanks. Welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Wednesday. Believe it or not, it's September the 1st, 2021. Our calling number is 563 888-999-3581 and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Yay, it's our show. And we love to do it. So thank you for the opportunity to lend us your ear, for lending us your ears so that we could have this conversation. And we'd also like to borrow your voice because this is definitely meant to be a conversation instead of a monologue. So we're honored that you're here, and we feel blessed to get to engage, to learn from you, to teach with you, to bring forward these ancient healing principles that have been lost through purpose or time. I'm not sure which. Whatever it is, it's time for restoration of the understanding of how this world works and our place in it. It's time for remembering who we are, to reconnect to the truth of who we are. The core of our work is first century Aramaic forgiveness, and the title of my book is Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And what you can do about it. So I'm going to just start right there with page, let's see, we're up to page 105 in the book. And if you don't have the book and you'd like to follow along with us, you can pick up a copy of it on Amazon or on eBay used. It's out of print. So we don't have new books to sell you, unfortunately. But you can also go to our website, whyagain.org, and you can pick up a copy of it there free. You can download it. English, German, Russian, Spanish. The Swedish copy is there, Danish. There's some parts of it in Thai. I'm not even sure. Farsi. What other languages are there? And If you happen to speak a language that we don't have the book translated in and would like to do the service of making the book available to your fellow native language speakers, whatever that language is, and would like to translate it, we'd love to get you a copy of it and have you translate it into whatever language you speak. And we'll put it online. We'll acknowledge you for translating it. And we'll make it available free so that we can fulfill our commitment to take this work to the best of our ability to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. Page 105, we're working on the topic, the body has a mind of its own. And we want to put forward the understanding that what we generally call a mind really isn't the mind at all. It's more like a computer function. You know, if I say, don't think about the color of your car, most people would respond with, well, here I am now thinking about the color of my car. And my offering is, no, in response to what I said, you're not thinking about the color of your car. The mind works, or what we call the mind, works by a law called the law of resonance, law of energy exchange. And so when I speak those words, it resonates information in you, and the mind simply responds with whatever's there, not thinking at all, but just cycling information. It's no more thinking than, you know, when you push a key on a computer, the computer's thinking. So when we really awaken to that process of thinking, that really is the ability to wake up to who we are as operators of our minds and to have the ability to introduce information to this database, this storage system called the body mind unit, multi-generational information storage system, that in many cases simply runs people's lives. We're here to put an end to that thing running your life. Because if it runs your life, then the past is running your life because everything that's stored in the thing is from the past. And people live in repeated, you know, why is this happening to me again? Resonated information from the past, and they think they're actually alive. There's no life in that. It's just repeat, repeat, repeat. We call it the replicant mind. And it's time for us to stop living the in the replicant mind and really starting to change things. So we're having this conversation with this character, Richard, this recalcitrant kind of guy who doesn't really want to hear anything that we're talking about. And we're looking at the idea that when things resonate, people tend to be run by whatever is in the mind, in the so-called mind, being resonated. And we're at the stage where we're talking about how the culture at large, individuals, you know, media, et cetera, have a responsibility for integrity, because our young people tend to simply play out whatever it is that they've lived. And now for the thought to Rich. I used to think that parents who guarded carefully what, or pardon me, I guess it's actually Richard here that's saying to me, I used to think that parents who guarded carefully what their children did and with whom their children had contact were overprotective. Perhaps they understood the potential contribution the community makes in building their child's reality structure. And in this work, we define reality not as what is. Reality is a construct in the human so-called mind. Most people's realities are simply reflections of content from the past. So we have the actualities in life, what actually happened, and then we have the realities. And, you know, for any given actuality, of course, you can have 1,000 different realities. Some of those realities are based in truth, and they'll be the ones that are connected to love. And some of those realities are based in total, complete fraud, and they're the ones connected to hostility and fear. What you know is whenever the mind is resonating some form of hostility or fear, that's a signal that the mind is using corrupt data and therefore is stuck in falsehood. So it goes on to say, this explains a lot about why children have no contact with a healthy community, be it a school or a neighborhood, get into trouble. I'm going to do something about delivering what I've learned here today to children, schools, parents, and teachers, Michael. He sounded pretty determined. We will be delighted to support your effort in any way we can, Richard. Many people who study this work become teachers of it. We invite anyone who feels it is their purpose to teach these tools to do so and to assist us in fulfilling our family's commitment to making these tools available to every mind on the planet. Let's look at the next phase of this understanding, the file folder effect. The words can be used to trigger files and realities and quote-unquote hook them together, so to speak. How long does it take to key realities together so they fire in concert with each other? Well, don't think about a purple alligator. Silly example. But if I see you in a week, a month, or a year and say, don't think about a purple, what will your mind fill with in the blank with? Alligator, of course. But probably won't even remember that a year from now, Richard chided. Well, that may be true, but that illustrates the point. One of the things that puts an event into long-term memory is emotion. Repetition will drive the energy even deeper into the mind. Let's look at an all-too-typical example. Imagine, over the first decade or two of life, a young boy is taught, through being yelled at and punished, the conflicting thoughts that sex is dirty and he should save it for the one he loves. Considering the file folder effect, what results do you expect you'd see from those links in the mind? Sounds like fertile ground for insanity, Richard blurts out. And yeah, there is so much insanity in our culture. And this file folder effect is such an important thing to understand and recognize, and to really become aware, truly conscious of, and remove links to things in the mind that are not accurate or true. And one of the ways that decency and goodness is destroyed in a person's mind is by linking it up to hostility and fear. And so this file folder effect and this so-called body's mind is an important key to understand we're offering. And so, Miss Jeannie, we are at about the 10-minute point, so that means we've got about 50 minutes left for conversation. Do you have anybody out there with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room?
No, it is quiet. Nobody has a hand up. So come on, press one.
So if you're out there in listener land, again, this is designed to be a dialogue. And we'd love to hear your voice. What's on your mind? How can we support you? I'm listening. And I can't imagine we don't have anybody out there with something to say, something to offer, something to question, something you need support with. Our objective in having this radio show is to have an interaction with you, is to hear from you. What's your experience of the tools? What's fitting in your life? What isn't fitting in your life? How can we make more sense of these tools for you? By the way, one of the things we're working on, and we'll have it complete, Jeannie keeps on me about it because I haven't touched it yet, but we're working on creating a flyer for the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop that we'll be doing in October. We're going to begin to do a Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop once each month. And on the Wednesday following the Saturday Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop, we'll do a Zoom conversation based on the experience from the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing Saturday, and entertain questions and look at specifics of that tool, Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. So if you're not on our mailing list, then you can go to our website, whyagain.org. And Jeannie, I'm not familiar with just where people sign up now on the new website. I know you've done a major overhaul and redesign that makes things more accessible. And I know that it used to be at the top in the center, but where is the link now if people want to sign up for our mailing list?
It's down at the bottom. So if you scroll all the way down, there's the button for supporting the work and donating, and then beside of it, you'll see the glowing heart like on the app, and it says join our mailing list. And you can always, type on the little search bar and type in join or mailing list, and it should bring up the link. Yeah, it does. It pops it right up, so you can just put in join or mailing list, and it'll pop right up there for you.
Cool. And as far as our mailing list goes, we're not going to spam you with all kinds of junk. We're not going to share it with anybody. It's only used for things related to this work to keep you posted on any kind of special offers or new workshops coming up, information like that. So it's something you'll only hear from us once every oftentimes only every month or two, or maybe a little more often, but we keep that to a minimum just to keep you posted on what's happening.
And I would
so I'm all ears.
I got a,
go ahead, sweetie.
I got a text yesterday from the lady who helps me with the website. It's also, on her server that we have it hosted and everything. And I just ask everybody to hold the space for her and her family. Her mother has lymph cancer, and is starting her first chemo treatment. And so Susan's down at her mom's house helping to take care of her. So just hold the space for that whole family as they're going through this, moving through the motions.
So, Susan, we hold you in our hearts. We extend our love to you and your mom, Daniel. That can be a difficult time. So I'm going to just get quiet and listen and see if there's somebody out there who's willing to push one and share with us what's on their minds. Maybe we just do a silent meditation, Jeannie.
For anybody who does meditation, and we've probably mentioned this before, and I'll put a link to it in the notes for today, but Michael and I have come across some music by Krishnadas.
Krishnadas?
Is that his name?
Yes.
I was bringing it up here. And the music is mostly Hindi. He studied in India, and it's just absolutely beautiful. We don't understand the words. Sometimes we'll look up songs and say English translation just to see, you know, what it is, what it's really saying. But just the tone of it and the music and his voice, it's just a wonderful setting to go into a meditation. Especially the song Show Me Love.
I want to know what love is.
Yeah, the title of it's actually Show Me Love, but yes. It's just awesome. So somebody press one. We have 41 minutes.
Let's have a conversation. What's on your mind? I was talking to a physician yesterday who's picked up on the work we've done around the energy field work and looking at the fact that the bony structure, there's a theory at least that I came up with a couple of decades ago, that the bony structure of the so-called body is actually a self-adjusting antenna, an antenna that's continuously in motion, and as it moves, when it moves through its proper range of motion, you know, from a physics point of view, the shape of an antenna determines the frequencies it receives. So, you know, if you've got a TV antenna, let's say you're up in Buffalo, New York, and you've got a TV antenna that tunes to, say, channel 2 up there, channel 4, and then you bring that TV antenna down here and put it on your house, and you've got a channel 2 and a channel 4, not going to get that station very well, because the shape of the antenna, the frequency being different of the station in New York than the one here, let's say, in Virginia for channel 2 and channel 4, you're not going to get very good reception. And so somebody goes up on the roof and turns the antenna backward or bends all of the arms of the antenna, you're not going to get much of an energetic exchange between the signal that's moving through the air and the antenna. Well, we live in this energy field. You know, if you go back to the ancient scriptures, the creator, love, says things like, in me you live, move, and have your being. Now, what that means when you tie into that law of resonance we've been talking about with the idea that the body has a mind of its own, is that if our energy system is made in the image and likeness of, that is a resonating frequency with the creator, is made of that stuff called love, and if we're moving through You know, they tell us, although we look and we say, oh, the Earth is standing still. Well, obviously it's not. We make it all the way around the sun, you know, once a year. And that's a pretty extensive trip. How fast do you need to be moving? Well, about 7,000 miles an hour. Shows you how much of an illusion the mind can create, because we have this illusion. We're pretty much standing still. But we're moving through this energy. We, made of the stuff called love, are moving through this energy field called love. And if we are aligned with that, then there is induced within our structure a flow of energy. And the flow of energy that's induced within our structure is the flow of love. You know, motion, if we have resonating energy fields, creates energy movement. You know, you go out and you get in your car and, gee, you know, there's nothing moving in your car. You turn a key, and because you have a battery supplying power to a motor, begins the turning of your starter. How does that happen? Well, electricity stored in the battery flows through a piece of wire. Do you know what happens when electricity flows through a piece of wire? Well, what occurs is that a standing wave, an energy field, is set up around that piece of wire. Now, if you have another piece of wire that is attuned with the right number of coils or the right number of turns in it to that energy that's moving through that first piece of wire, there's going to be a magnetic field set up, and all of a sudden, because electricity is flowing through this coil of wire, your starter is going to begin to turn. When it begins to turn, you know, if you remember the old-time movies, you'd watch somebody get out there with a hand crank, and they had to start the car with a hand crank. Well, somebody came up with the idea of making an electric starter. Otherwise, you'd still be out there cranking your car to get it started. So battery stores electricity. Electricity flows through wire. Wire creates magnetic field, creates attraction or repulsion to another magnetic field. And all of a sudden, out of the presence of electricity, you have motion. Your starter moves. And when your starter moves, it cranks an engine, and that cranking of the engine, again, electricity flows and creates a spark, and that spark lights gasoline, creates compression in the cylinders of your car, and your motor begins to run. Now, all of a sudden, you don't need any energy from your battery. In fact, the reverse occurs. Now you've got an alternator, or in the old time, a generator in your car. That alternator starts to spin, and because of the spinning of the wire wrapped around the coil in your alternator, that moves through a magnetic field, and it induces in the piece of wire a flow of electricity that now restores the energy to your battery and charges the battery. When you understand how those principles operate, then you understand that you're like a coil of wire moving through space at about 7,000 miles an hour, and inducing every cell in your structure is the flow of love. And unless you've got another idea, unless you set something else into motion in your cellular structure, the natural state of your physiology is going to be that of the flow of the presence of love. It's our natural condition. But we can overwhelm the system with different energetic patterns, you know, a cultural pattern or a family pattern of rage and fear and guilt, condemnation, gossip, slander, vengeance, all kinds of crazy things. We can overwhelm the natural system with those things that are unnatural. And we can feel moving in our physiology, which would be akin to a motor moving or turning within a car. We can feel the energetic patterns of whatever we've stored there. What we're offering with this work is that on an energetic basis, if there's something moving in you that you say, I don't like this, the reason it's moving is because it's there, and the reason you don't like it is because it doesn't belong there. Rage and hatred and fear and guilt are energetic patterns, energetic presences that do not belong in physiology. And what we uncovered many years ago, and I offer a huge shout out to a dear friend who's passed now, Dan McDougall, who did much of the original work on the Aramaic language, who acquired initially the Kabbalist manuscript that we work from, and really tapped into this whole idea of how this energy system works from the first century Aramaic perspective. We spent a lot of time working and refining our understanding of that and come up with a specific step-by-step technology for how, if there's an energetic pattern moving in you that you don't like, you can remove it. The technology in the first century Aramaic language was called forgiveness. If you're not using that technology, we have a full explanation of it on our website. It's available to you free. We'd be delighted if you jump on the website, whyagain.org. Click up in the upper left-hand corner where the button says Start Here. And just start clicking links. It'll walk you through an understanding through the building of the brain cells. You know, if you didn't know how a generator or an alternator works, notice that now when I say, well, what generates electricity, you've got brain cells for that. If you've never heard of such a thing before, you've got the beginning of the understanding of how a starter works, how a motor works, how a generator works. It's called building brain cells. The main brain cells we want to support being available to everyone is the brain cells for how forgiveness works. And forgiveness is a tool with which, if there's content, energetic, if there are energetic patterns stored within your physiology, you know, it's kind of like your cells are like a storage battery. The battery stores the energy that starts your car. Your cells store mind energy. In fact, if you go to the opening words in the book of John in the New Testament, where we're told it's all about religion, it doesn't say, as the Greeks tell us, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, and they equate that Word with a person. What that text actually says is, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. This is the beginning of a huge, huge piece of understanding that literally, when we think of thought, we have the energetic pattern that initiates dynamics that will ultimately become part of your flesh, part of your physiology. And if things that were never designed for a structure that's made to incarnate love are resonant within your structure, then the application of forgiveness, the understanding of how these tools work, and the application of forgiveness is about how to remove those energetic patterns that, you know, when they move, people are just miserable. A lot of people think, well, life is miserable. And they think that life is miserable because structured within their structure, stored within their cellular structure, is misery. But life isn't miserable. Life is an awesome, sweet, profound opportunity to experience ourselves as human beings, as the active presence of love. And if our physiology is generating something other than the presence of love, it's because there have been energetic patterns put into the structure that don't belong there. Now, it's interesting, in the ancient Aramaic language, when this described, they had a word that described putting energetic patterns within human physiology that didn't belong within human physiology. And the word was sin. It's got nothing to do with what the Greeks have taught us about evil and bad and wrong, all of that sort of stuff. The word sin in Aramaic is simply an archery term. And when you fired at the target, if you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper would inform you by utilizing the word sin. You were off the mark. Now, I know there are all kinds of implications and insane ideas that have been sown within our minds about this idea of sin. And probably one of the most tragic ones that has destroyed so many lives down through the ages is that people have personalized that word and convinced themselves and others that that's a word that describes who they are. So my offering is, if you've bought into the fraud or the lie that sin in some way implies something about you, then you have been defrauded by someone who either is in the business of fraud or just is ignorant and doesn't know any better. So all that sin is a word that informs us about how this energy system is operating. And when it's operating on an energy that's off the mark, it's time to wake up. It's time to realize who we are and shift out of the energetic patterns that are inhuman. And we've got so much of that in the world today. You look at the rage and the fear. You look at the bizarre implications of the kinds of things that are going on in our world today. You say, how is it possible that we have degraded so far from the truth of being love, of being beings created in the image and likeness of love? How did we get so far away? Well, you know, there's this word sophistry, and it's interesting because if you talk to people in this culture oftentimes today, they'll tell you the word sophist has something to do with wisdom. And that's a twist that's happened that turns backward this idea of sophistry. If you go back into your Greek history, you'll find that the sophists were a group of Greek philosophers who, in essence, charged big bucks to the wealthy to go around and teach their children how to lie, and lie in such a subtle way that the lies appeared to be true. You know, an example of that, the sophistry just is so rampant in the world today. I just posted an article on nutrition a few days ago, and a very basic sophistry would be, you know, somebody who went to the Madison Avenue Advertising Agency, created this white pasty stuff that they called bread. You know, the farmers grew wheat in their fields, and, you know, today's oftentimes wheat grown in fields before they ever plant the seed in the soil that's meant to be vital and alive with organisms and life. They poured 10 gallons per acre of a toxic poison called glyphosate on that acre of land. So they made sure that everything was absolutely wiped out, dead, nothing alive in the soil at all. Then they planted seeds that had been manipulated in their energetic patterns so that they could withstand the glyphosate. They grew the wheat, and then once the wheat grew, they sprayed it with more glyphosate, more poison, in order to cause it to dry prematurely. And then they learn how to mill that wheat, how to grind that wheat and remove from it everything that had nutrition in it. All of the wheat germ, all of the vitamin E, all of the vitamin C, all of the vitamins they removed from that grain of wheat. And they went out and made a profit selling it to the pig farmers. The pig farmers know you need nutrition to keep your pigs healthy. They don't go to doctors in the fancy hospitals in the cities and tell them nutrition's got nothing to do with the state of your health or disease. They know that if they don't feed their pigs right, their pigs will be sick. Their pigs will not reproduce. Their pigs will not last very long, and their vet bills will be enormous. So the sophists found out how to take all the nutrition out of the wheat and sell it to the pig farmer. And then they hired Madison Avenue to advertise how this white poison leftover paste that they turned into a thing they called white bread, they got the advertisers to tell humans, to brainwash humans into believing this was food. Now, I dare you, you know, if I were to go into restaurants in this city, and I don't know how many thousand restaurants there are, I would be hard-pressed to find one piece of bread. You know, if I wanted to go in and have a sandwich or have a, you know, a burger or whatever, I would be hard-pressed to find one slice of bread that had one scintilla of natural nutrition in it. That would be a challenge to do. And isn't it interesting? I mean, how deep is the sophistry that literally throughout this whole city, throughout this whole country, I mean, there are places you can go to health food stores. You can go to some places where you'll actually find some measure of nutrition in a loaf of bread. But otherwise, I mean, literally, you go to virtually any restaurant in town and you have to ask the question, do you have any food that actually has nutrition in it, that hasn't been adulterated? That's sophistry. And that sophistry applies in arena after arena after arena and after arena. The same principle applies in so many churches where they take the teachings of this man, Yeshua, who said, there is a work to be done, and here's how you do forgiveness. And those people will tell you, oh, there's nothing you can do. You're a hopeless, helpless, quote-unquote, sinner. And there's nothing you can do. We'll just let somebody else do it for you. And so people who could be doing something about changing their lives sit back and go, oh, somebody's going to fix it for me. Somebody's going to save me. And they do nothing but buy whatever they've been sold. And they've been sold a sick bill of goods that's fraught with lies and sophistry. This work is about cleaning up the mind so that one has the brain cells for how life really works. And, you know, in this case, what nutrition actually looks like, what food actually looks like and tastes like. You know, you walk into most restaurants and the food is so, has such a sophisticated taste. That is, it's filled with sugar and then salt, toxic chemicals, preservatives, but it's overridden. The tastes are fooled. Again, it's sophistry. The tastes are, taste buds are fooled into thinking this is food. And people wonder why they're dying of horrific diseases. And then they go to doctors who present them with treatment. And virtually every treatment that most doctors have are called drugs. And drugs, you'll notice each drug, if you read the insert on the package, each drug introduces into a person's body the potential for and the actuality of many, many diseases. I mean, just read the insert on the package. Why in the name of healing would you introduce something that brings into the structure disease after disease after disease after disease after disease? Why? Because just like the empty white bread, the guy who milled the bread and sold the nutrition to the pig farmer and then sold the leftover white poison to the baker, they made their money twice. And then when people are sick, they're right there to melt their pockets. That whole game is a game of sophistry. And it's time for us to wake up to how we've been tricked and to begin to function truly as a being with faculties that can tell a genuine energetic pattern from a false one, truly as the active presence of love. An important skill in doing that is to remove or forgive everything in the structure that is false and does not belong within the structure. And in essence, that's what we're here to deliver, is the tools for doing that. Again, the primary tool is a tool of removal, the tool of forgiveness, the tool that removes the lies, the frauds, the hostility, and fear from this physiological system so that we can go back to functioning as who we truly are. And that should arouse some thoughts for somebody who's going to put their hand up and say, well, Michael, what about, or tell me more about, or how does this part, how does that work? How can we support you? What's on your mind? If you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581, 563-999-3581. If you call that number, if you're listening on a station that doesn't link into our control panel, so we can see that you're there, call that number, you'll be listening to the show. And then if you push 1, through the magic of technology, signal will come up in Jean's control panel, and she'll know you want to speak to us and introduce us by your area code. So how can we support you? What's on your mind? Miss Jeannie, anything happening in the chat room? Anybody in the phone queue with a hand up?
No, it is silent out here.
All is quiet, eh? Well, I guess all that we need to say for today has been said then. I know we have our granddaughter here today, and we're going to head out and go see the Paw Patrol movie with her today. So we're going to take her out and have some playtime. And so if nobody else has any thoughts or questions for us, I'm ready to close the show out and get prepared to take Ari Rain to see the Paw Patrol. What do you think, sweetie?
Well, I was hoping somebody would just press 1, but it looks like the switchboard's going to stay quiet.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you all for the time you spend with us, and it would be wonderful if you, you know, carried a little notebook or had a little program in your phone when you have questions that you make a note of them so that when the showtime comes around, you've got that handy and can pop in and be part of the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Other than that, we'll just close the show out and say thank you for joining us, and have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.